Okay, ladies and gentlemen, can I welcome you to this evening's event, this evening's public lecture. Tonight we're starting a new venture for the Hellenic Observatory. That is, we're starting a venture with lights which are going up and down and making everyone confused. I hope. I see, it's okay. There is some control at the side. Okay. This evening we're starting a new venture, which is to have two parallel sets of public events this academic year. One is to continue with our research seminars on a Tuesday evening in the Cadre House seminar room. It's familiar to most of you. But we're also seeking to establish a new set of lectures about key policy issues which are to be given by policy practitioners, those with professional experience. So we hope to have these two parallel sets of events. Firstly, the more conventional research seminars, but as with this evening, a public lecture given by a policy practitioner, someone who can bring professional experience to the topic. Now, it's my very great pleasure to introduce someone who has been a long-term friend, our speaker this evening, Dimitris Katsoulis. I was working out the other day that we've known each other for 34 years, when we were students together. I should explain, I think on my behalf, that I started as a student at least 10 years before I was born. But that's not the case with my colleague here. So I was also thinking that for 34 years, I've been asking Dimitris various questions. He's endured my questions, and I've benefited from his answers. Or alternatively, perhaps vice versa, as you may wish. But it's my great pleasure to welcome him. His career testifies to his different interests and expertise across a broad range of areas. He is, dare I say, the archetypal Renaissance man. He's combined politics with the arts, a number of different public appointments. In the 1980s, in the world of politics, he rose to be a senior advisor and then the chief speechwriter to Konstantin Mitsotakis, then leader of Neo Demokratia, the main opposition party, and later was his chief advisor and speechwriter whilst he was prime minister. Subsequently, and more recently, he performed a similar role for Dora Bakoyannis as foreign minister, and has served New Democracy in various guises in the party apparatus. I guess I should claim on his behalf that all of the best speeches of Konstantin Mitsotakis and Dora Bakoyannis were probably drafted by my friend here. The speeches that you liked came from him. The speeches that you didn't like were an adoration from someone else. More particularly, in the 80s and 90s, he was one of a small number of people in Greece who became a channel, a conduit for the introduction of liberal ideas within New Democracy, liberal economic ideas within the Greek system, from the think tank KEPE, Center for Political Research and Information. He influenced various members of New Democracy and various candidates for the party in a more liberal direction. More recently than that, when Mitsotakis became Prime Minister, he served as Secretary General for Forests and the Environment. More recently, of course, he has served as Secretary General for European Union Affairs under the Karamanlis government. Now, as you can see, we have entitled Dimitris as the former Secretary General for EU Affairs. We're quick off the mark here. 10 days ago, he was the Secretary General. But in these days of internet precision, we wish to be speedy in our reporting of current positions. I can only hope that an invitation to come and speak at the LSE Hellenic Observatory is not some kind of kiss of death. Because when we invited him, of course, he was the Secretary General. And we safely assumed that the system, in its wisdom, would continue with him as Secretary General. But these are the vulgarities of democracy. And events have overtaken us in that respect. Without further ado, I'm delighted to introduce my good friend to speak on this topic of expanding and aligning the European Union, European integration and neighbourhood policies, a Greek overview. Can you please give him a very warm welcome?
Thank you very much, Kevin, for your brilliant introduction of spanning 35 years in 5 minutes. It was wonderful. It had a sort of frightening aspect. What do you think of it?
I mean, here in Paris.
It's the years. But now, ladies and gentlemen, Your Excellency, the Ambassador of Greece to the United Kingdom, I'm delighted to be here at the LSE. It's certainly not my first visit, but it is my first visit as a speaker in a seminar. And I'm going to talk to you about mostly about things you probably know, but I'm simply going to put them into the perspective of the policies we try to follow as a country and as a ministry. As the title implies, my premise is very simple. In a time of a highly globalized crisis, in a period of economic, in a world and environmental and economic crisis, the EU is doing two things simultaneously. The one is pursue its institutional renovation with the Lisbon Treaty, etc., and at the same time, it is reshaping the entire set of policies for its immediate periphery. That is, the Mediterranean, the Eastern Partnership, and the Black Sea. So you have at the same time, in a period when other priorities seem to indicate that we should deal mostly with the crisis, etc., the crisis itself, as well as the Georgian crisis, which put us before a crisis in front of our doorstep, has accelerated policies which we follow in all fronts, the internal front and the front around us, let alone, of course, our positions vis-a-vis the climate change, the world economic crisis, etc. But my premise is that we are heading forward in these two fronts. Now, in this context, I shall analyze not only briefly these two fronts, as I described them, but the role of Greece as well in shaping or putting added value to the above policies. To an audience which I suppose has a vivid interest in both European and Greek affairs, I believe this could be rather welcome. Ladies and gentlemen, for half a century, the European Union has pursued two major policies, and more, it has done so more or less simultaneously: deeper integration and enlargement. The two processes have been followed, as I said, in parallel. A growing membership has been part of the development of European integration right from the start. The EU today, with 27 member states and a population exceeding this year 500 million people, is incomparably more all-embracing than the original European community of 50 years ago, with 6 members and a population of less than 200 million. But my premise is, ever since I became the first Greek Robert Schuman scholar to go to the European Parliament, my idea was deeply ingrained into my mind that the EU is not just an institutional entity. To start with, as an institutional entity, as you all know, it's a very sui generis formation, not similar to anything international law has seen before it. But it is above all, I believe, a community of values based on certain assumptions that grew out of the Second World War, that is, the desire to avoid a new war on the European continent, collective decision-making, peace and freedom, democracy and the rule of law, tolerance, and social and regional if you like, so solidarity. The EU enlargement process has assisted our continent in overcoming political problems as well as regional conflicts, in building good neighborly relations, stabilizing democracies, generating political reforms, as well as economic and social development in the acceding countries. Remember that in the early 70s, almost the entire southern tier of Europe, Greece, Spain, Portugal, were dictatorships. The objective now is to preserve these benefits and to further develop both integration and the policy of enlarging the Union. As I said at the beginning, the two policies go together, they should continue going together. The enlargement process has therefore been probably the most successful and certainly one of the most important policies of the EU. We have agreed in principle at this stage to extend the EU perspective to the Southeast Europe as well, including Turkey, when the necessary requirements are met by the interested countries, and this is important to remember, when the necessary requirements are met. And this is not a blackmail. It is the same, very same conditions under which we all became members of the EU. A gradual and carefully managed enlargement process leading to full membership of the EU can be a win-win situation for both the European Union and the interested countries. Now, the recent international financial crisis, as well as the Georgian crisis last year, provided Europe with valuable lessons to be learned. Both crises have made it more imperative for Europe to change in order to be able to face the challenges of the modern globalized international system, be it financial, political, security, environmental, or otherwise. Internally, as I said at the beginning, the Union has reached vital crossroads as we enter the final stage of adopting the Lisbon Treaty, following the positive result of the Irish referendum. It is no secret that the treaty is the result of a major compromise. We all know that. It is also no secret that the treaty does not give answers to all our problems, and also that it may hide among its stipulations some arrangements that need to be proven to be effective. Nevertheless, with it, Europe definitely becomes more democratic, a little bit more transparent. Its decision-making process will be better streamlined. The whole Union will be strengthened and more visible. The Treaty of Lisbon can give Europe a clearer voice worldwide. Briefly, as you know, we'll have a president with a 2-year term in office, a new High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security, who will be simultaneously the Vice President of the Commission. We'll have the European External Action Service to support him, and we are still in discussions in the various ministries how this is going to be staffed, who is going to take what shares, what it will be the geographical component. If the Greek representative will go to Canada, then where will the Italian go, and so on. But this is part of this constant compromise, which is the European Union. Furthermore, we now have a single legal personality for the Union. This is very important for jurists, but it is important. The Union didn't have a single legal personality. And this will strengthen its political weight, making it more effective on the world stage and a more visible partner vis-a-vis third countries and international organizations. The treaty also foresees an enhanced role, and this should be remembered, under the principle of subsidiarity for both the European Parliament and national parliaments, who, as you know, will have now a role in the decision-making process. And finally, I would like to mention, to be brief, the possibility of a pan-European referendum foreseen in the treaty, which requires 1 million signatures, but 1 million signatures in a union of 500 million people may not prove to be so difficult to achieve. Therefore, on an issue of a high environmental, political, social, or other importance, you may see something from the grassroots coming up and pulling the union to start deciding. And this is important. Last but not least, I will mention the European Security and Defense Policy, which will likewise strengthen the European Union's role in international peacekeeping missions and in situations in crisis. Let me conclude this chapter of why we are at the crossroads for the EU itself by mentioning that I'm very proud indeed that my country, even though it came into the EU in 1981, has managed to be at the moment in the core of all EU policies, in the nucleus of the EU. We are at the Schengen, we are at the Euro, we are at the Common Security and Defense Policy. Greece is in the what we often describe as the internal cycle of the EU, and it has played, in our days, a considerable role in bringing the compromise about in Brussels, a role for which I think it's for the Prime Minister and Mrs. Bakoyiannis to speak, but it was, believe me, not at all negligible. Now, this is what happens inside, and we are full of expectations that in a few months we will be better streamlined to face major challenges like the environment in Copenhagen and so on. And the second part of my premise is the EU at the same time is looking again at its immediate periphery and adopting policies for addressing it. In July 14th, 2008, in Paris, I had the privilege of being there, 43 states launched the Union for the Mediterranean with the aim of creating an institutional framework for the south of the sea and, of course, the east. Greece has played a pivotal role in this new initiative. I had the honor of having the file for the Mediterranean Union, and we insisted with the French, and I will tell you what we introduced to this idea from the Greek side. We have introduced, first of all, the concept of complementarity of the projects between the north and the south shore of the Mediterranean. What do I mean by this? As you know, through the structural and other funds of the EU, billions actually of euros have been spent in our countries in the south of Europe for projects. We insisted that the money spent in this way should not be lost on the other side, and that therefore there should be a strategic plan that the projects in the north shore of Africa should be complementing the motorways, the railway lines, the harbors, etc., that we already have built or are building on the European side. This was a Greek idea and it was adopted. The second idea, we insisted also on the inclusion of the Adriatic countries, which were not in the framework of the initial French idea. It was Greece's insistence that the Adriatic should also be included, and it is indeed included. Third, we have requested a balance in projects, not only between North and South, but also between the Eastern Mediterranean and the Western Mediterranean. Let me be clear on that now that I'm not in office. It is obvious that with France, Italy, and Spain, three large EU countries in the Western Mediterranean, the whole idea, the whole project as it was coming out, seemed to lean towards the Maghreb and the Western Mediterranean. Now, the Eastern Mediterranean is an area which probably needs much more assistance and stability and help, politically and economically, than the Western Mediterranean. And Greece was the only country of the southern tier of the EU to be so vividly interested in the Eastern Mediterranean, for obvious reasons. In order to claim our status as a country, we couldn't mention our size, because our size is not impressive. But there are two facts that are impressive, that make Greece a very particular case. The first is the length of our coasts. The length of the Greek coast is 16,000 kilometers, which comprise one-third of the entire Mediterranean of 45 countries, of 19 countries. Mediterranean is about 45,000 kilometers. One third, approximately, of the entire Mediterranean shoreline is Greek. The second is the richness, if I may call it that, that Greece brought to the EU with its merchant marine. The Greek merchant marine is, the tonnage of the Greek merchant marine is half of the entire 27 member states of the EU. This is not just an added advantage in EU negotiations with third countries like China, the United States, Russia, etc. At least 700 of our tankers are previewed to be able to carry natural gas in case of crisis. In this way, Greece can considerably help in periods of energy crisis. And this happened this year when Bulgaria became absolutely dry at the time when there were 20 degrees Celsius minus, and our ships brought liquefied gas from Algeria and through Greek Macedonia they poured it into Bulgaria, and something the Bulgarian press was quick to praise, and I was delighted. And now we have been institutionalizing this, and we build a pipeline from Kavala, the northern port of Greece, right into Bulgaria in order to help that country avoid a similar crisis in the future. So to complete the idea of what we're trying to do with the Mediterranean, I would also tell you that we have insisted in Marseille, Ms. Bakoyannis gave with Mr. Moratinos a considerable struggle to include the Arab League even as an observer, because that was a demand of the Arab side. And they are very satisfied that they got the Arab League as a permanent observer in the Mediterranean Union, and they also got one of the two presidents to be Arabic or of the southern side. So they are more or less satisfied. Now, as you also know, the Union for the Mediterranean has its development, the pace of its structuring has not been impressive. And the reason for not being impressive is that right after it was formulated in Marseille, Paris first and then Marseille, the Gaza crisis erupted. So the Arabs pulled out, there were no talks, we're sending our emissaries to meetings and they were coming out back with empty hands. Now there is movement, there are a lot of logistics to be decided, like who is going to pay the secretaries, who is going to pay the officers, the diplomats, etc. But I think now it's moving ahead. Now, so Europe is trying to redefine its periphery as well as its internal structure, starting with the Mediterranean. I would say that, as we discussed with Mrs. Wallace last summer, why the Mediterranean first? I have an answer for that. The reason is that the situation to the east of the EU is and will continue for many years to be in an institutional flux. We don't know when, how, etc., these countries will, if ever, will, they will become members of the EU. But we do know that the Southern Tier will not become a member of the EU. And that we know. We are not going to have, there's a lot of debate on Turkey already. Imagine there is no possibility of having the Arab world and Israel in the EU. They can have a privileged relationship with the EU. And this is, I believe, why Sarkozy, and I think he was right in that, put an emphasis to starting and fixing the framework of our political relationships with the Arab world and the Mediterranean. Now, just after the Mediterranean Union was starting being formulated, Poland and Sweden naturally came forward and said, what about the eastern dimension of the EC? There was, of course, both a southern neighborhood policy and an eastern neighborhood policy, but as Sarkozy wanted something more for the south, so Poland and Sweden wanted something more for the east. We had no objection. I remember when I was visited by the Polish and Swedish ambassadors, who were a little bit awkward looking, because they thought we would oppose the idea, because of this idea fix of Greece being the typical Mediterranean country and so on. And when they said, we're enthusiastically responding and saying, look, Greece was always looking north, particularly in the Middle Ages, who Christianized the Slavs, who opened up the great commercial influxes in Eastern Europe. It was the Greeks, medieval Greeks. So we were interested in Eastern dimension as well. So this was also adopted December last, it's not even a year now, for enhancing the Union's relationship with six countries. Six countries were singled out. I'll mention them. Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Moldova, the Ukraine, and Belarus. In the Prague Eastern Partnership Summit in May 2009, the participants declared that the main goal of the Eastern Partnership is to create the necessary conditions for accelerating the political association and further economic integration between the European Union and the six partner countries. The Eastern Partnership carries also a clear political message. It is maintaining and bolstering these countries' courts towards reform. It will provide additional impetus to their political, economic, social, and regional development. And to be a little bit more practical, 600 million euros were earmarked, in addition to the neighborhood policy, for the Eastern Partnership at that summit. So it was, the economic crisis was not all that blooming at the time, so everybody was more generous. I want to be clear on one point. It is not declared, and I believe it is not, the Eastern Partnership is not aimed at Russia. That is the general assumption. Russia, nevertheless, remains a crucial partner for the EU and for the members of the Eastern Partnership because they are very close to Russia. Therefore, as the Russian crisis and the aftermath of the crisis and the efforts we are now not sparing show, we need good working relationships with a good working relationship with Russia. It's not easy, but I must say that the Greek OSCE presidency in Corfu initiated the Corfu process, which everybody acclaimed as a good step in the right direction. It is a step, not more than a step, but it's important as being one. Now, let me complement this by saying that we are also strong advocates of the Black Sea Synergy, which was an initiative for the Black Sea. In 1996, it was a Greek-Bulgarian idea. And now it has its own bank in Thessaloniki, its own funds, and so on. We were very keen to preserve the Black Sea Synergy intact from any implications of overlapping with this partnership. And for two reasons. One is that this was an older initiative and it started having its own structures and it was useful. The second, and politically more important, is that the synergy, unlike the partnership, engages the two major players in the Black Sea, Russia and Turkey. And in our view as the easternmost state of the old EU, to ignore Russia and Turkey is not wise. You have to engage them not only in talks, but institutionally as well. And the synergy is not a negligible forum. I don't say it's an important forum, but it's a not negligible forum to engage these two countries. And it was a success that in February 14, 2008, we managed to link the synergy officially with the EU, and we had the kickoff event in Kiev, in the Ukraine. Dear friends, as we have seen, the EU has been recently moving simultaneously ahead, both internally, to complete its institutional transformation, and externally by formulating two or rather three policies for its wider periphery. But each and every member of the EU, either individually or in collaboration with its neighbors, can actively contribute to achieving the European goals of stability and prosperity. I will now try to tell you a few words of what Greece has tried to do in this respect. Allow me to believe that there is hardly a clearer regional example in the southeast of Europe than Greece. Greece had staunchly supported the inclusion of Slovenia, Romania, and Bulgaria into the EU, and we strongly advocate the European perspective of the other Balkan countries in time and when the conditions are met. This was clearly institutionally stipulated during the Greek presidency in 2003 with the Thessaloniki agenda. And before leaving the ministry, I was dreaming of the Thessaloniki 2 for enhancing regional co-ownership in view of membership. I hope the new government will pick up this idea. Greece has ever since actively promoted regional co-ownership, the Euro-Atlantic perspective of these countries, and has been a strong contributor in the Southeast Europe cooperation process. This is the regional initiative, under the aegis of which, last year, we created the Regional Cooperation Council, those of you who know it as RCC. The RCC streamlines and proposes applied policies of investment, training, infrastructure, etc., for these countries in view of membership. I wouldn't like to go too much in details about that, but this is now preparing a plan under the aegis of the Swedish presidency and the Commission for infrastructure. Greece's idea, I will only tell you this, I visited Sarajevo, which is the seat of the Regional Cooperation Council, and then I invited the Secretary General to Athens to discuss issues. And Greece's idea is that we must close the missing links in the Balkans. It took me 11 hours to go to Sarajevo. This is unacceptable if you want regional cooperation. You need to have the roads, the railways, the energy networks, etc. Otherwise, the rest is petty talk without practical results. Now, in the field of investment and economic activity, more than 3,500 Greek enterprises are established in the Balkans. To give you one number, there are more than 2,500 branches of Greek banks in these countries already, and the Greek banks were among the least toxic in the EU. They were among the healthiest banks. The total amount of Greek foreign direct investment into the region exceeds 20 billion euros, and this does not include capital flowing into the region from London, Cyprus, and other centers where Greek money exists. So this we don't know how much this is, and we cannot count it. But we do know that nearly 200,000 jobs have been created in these countries thanks to Greek investment, and this is a clear political as well as economic message. It's also a social message that we have contributed to the measure of our ability to the social stability and economic progress of these countries, not alone at the political level by supporting the Euro-Atlantic perspective. It's essential that we also did this in these highly practical fashion. In addition, there are $825 million directly from the Greek taxpayers' pocket for infrastructure projects in the basic Balkan countries, apart from the EU aid. This is Greek direct aid. One word only about another important development in the region, to which we try to play as much a role as we can. It's the creation of a coherent and unified energy market in Southeast Europe. New infrastructures, which are about to start, like the Burgas-Alexandroupolis gas oil pipeline, which will decongest the Bosporus Straits, the Turkey-Greece-Italy pipeline, the agreement was signed yesterday, actually, or the day before yesterday, between Italy and Turkey, and Greece had already signed with both. And the Turkey-Greece-Bulgaria-Romania natural gas pipeline, as well as the short pipeline I mentioned earlier for supplying Bulgaria in case of need. And of course, there's the South Stream, And the only one to which we don't participate of these major pipelines is the Nabucco, because this is much norther than our frontier. Ladies and gentlemen, let us look at the Balkans, let us look at the southeast of Europe. What do we see? 10 years after the bloody wars in Yugoslavia. The first thing, as I described it once in Washington in a lecture, is you first see an arch of stability, which didn't exist in the past. I call it an arch because geographically it does form an arch. Slovenia, Croatia, Romania, Bulgaria, Greece. You have already a circle in the Balkans which is stable, members of the EU and NATO. Croatia is about to become a member of the EU shortly now that the Slovenian dispute is over. So you already have an unprecedented arch of stability, and we ourselves enjoy land frontiers with the EU for the first time, rather than being an isolated off-post. Then you have a couple of countries in between. Croatia is about to be a member. He is already a member of NATO, is about to become a member of the EU. And then you have Serbia, where the situation has ameliorated. There is a pro-Western government, pro-European government. They have arrested Karadzic, but they haven't arrested the other two. Montenegro has applied, and Albania have applied for membership of the EU. They are both stable countries. Elections are much better conducted. There is economic progress. So I would define these countries in the middle, not exactly yet in the total arch of stability, but approaching it. And then you still have, unfortunately, the corridor of instability, as I call it, which is the eternal problem of Bosnia-Herzegovina, with 174 ministers at 14 institutional levels. How can this country be governed? With the nearly non-speaking terms between the Republika Srpska and the... You all know what's going on. The recent talks 2 days ago were more or less a failure again. I have, on the order of my minister, I have been to Bosnia very recently, and I was honored with 1.5 hours meeting with the Prime Minister. And we had a very frank discussion about the situation in the country. And I think we didn't tell him anything original, anything he didn't hear from other people as well, that they should simplify the administrative structure, that they should create institutions that, to bring the communities closer together rather than isolate them, etc. But unfortunately, as I told you just 2 days ago, all these talks on the evolution of the high representative to the EU representative, etc., they all went not very well. Montenegro is going much better. Then you have, of course, Kosovo, which is central to Balkan stability. It is no secret that Greece has not recognized the unilateral declaration of independence of Kosovo. We don't like unilateral declarations of independence that seem to mutilate existing countries and would perhaps create a very negative precedent for other areas. And it has had some effect in the Caucasus, as we know. But also the situation on the ground, though ameliorated, is not ideal. There is a lot to be done, and on all sides, international community, the Kosovars must at last face corruption and trafficking, which is flourishing in the country. Unemployment is soaring. Our not recognition does not mean interest. There was a large business mission in Kosovo, and we extend help, and the Greek presence in K4 was the fourth largest from all over the world. We had 800 troops in K4, so we do try, to the measure of our ability, to stabilize Kosovo, and we wait, like many other countries do, for the decision of The Hague on the Serbian recourse, whether Kosovo legally succeeded or not. This is the situation. And finally, I will not go into great detail because you know the situation with the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, as the United Nations has decided that it should be called until a solution is found. I'm sorry the United States of America did not keep the necessary distances from the dispute so that we could find it easier a solution by hastening to recognize it under its constitutional name. As I told Daniel Freed in Washington, I told him, you have been taking parts in the dispute. You should let us alone deal with it. But the situation is not raising optimism. The new Gruevski government is doing everything in its hand to provoke Greece. I mean, they couldn't design it better. They rename roads, stadia, publish new books. At a time of economic crisis, they order statues of ancient Macedonians worth $22 million. If the government in Greece or Britain decided in the middle of an economic crisis, which are much larger countries and richer, to spend $22 million for statues, the governments would be under severe scrutiny, even in the United States, let alone. And the entire, to give you a measure of the economy of that country, it's about 5 billion, the total GDP is about $5 billion. And if you combine it with one of the poorest, oldest members of the EU, which is Greece, which is $260 billion. So this is the smallness of this economy. And they should be taking care of their money and of good neighborly relations. In two words, Greece believes that training an entire nation, that its neighbor occupies part of it, and abducting, as the 300 academics signed in the famous letter to Obama, abducting the history of your neighbor is not a good example of good neighborly relations. The good neighborly relations, as you know, are at the core of the conditions required to become a member of NATO and the EU. Some people, including the members of the Commission, say, no, it's a bilateral dispute. In our view, it's not a bilateral dispute. It touches upon the core of the good neighborly relations that are required for any member. You cannot import problems into NATO and the EU and expect these two organizations to function smoothly. You better solve the problems before you bring them into the house. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I will now reach my conclusion by turning only very briefly, because it's not part of my subject in the Southeast, your attention to Cyprus and Turkey, but I will only say a few words. The intercommunal talks are continuing. It is to be hoped that the leaders of the two communities will reach an agreement, because it's long overdue. Nicosia is the last divided European capital by a wall in its middle. And I do hope that Turkey will allow the Turkish Cypriots to bargain, to negotiate on their own behalf. We do not interfere. We don't tell the Greek Cypriots what to do. They are a country in the EU. They have their own voice. We don't tell them what to do. The same should be applied to the Turkish Cypriots. Unfortunately, as you probably know, under the guise of protecting them, there are now more settlers from Anatolia in Cyprus than Turkish Cypriots. So who knows what the true will of the Turkish Cypriots are when the inhabitants of the occupied zone are mostly settlers from Anatolia. And this is a cause of concern. How can the Turkish Cypriots really tell us what they want when they're in elections, everybody votes, or nearly everybody votes? But we do hope that Turkey, minding its own course towards Europe, will also wish to settle this question as we do. So let me resume. I have talked of the European Union's progress towards institutional reform. I have tried to present to you the broader lines of the two new major policies for the periphery of the European Union, namely the Union for the Mediterranean and the Eastern Partnership, coupled with the Black Sea Synergy. I have briefly tried to focus your attention to the achievements and problems in Greece's own neighborhood, the southeast of Europe. I have described in some detail what has already emerged as an arch of stability in the Balkans, the progress achieved by Slovenia, Romania, and Bulgaria, now members of the EU, the progress likewise of Croatia, Serbia, Montenegro, and Albania, which occupy a lesser status in the stability arch. I have similarly explained why there still remains a corridor of instability, as I describe it, focusing your attention to the remaining problems in Bosnia-Herzegovina, Kosovo, and the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. I have then drawn your attention to Greece's own political and economic role as a factor of stability and prosperity in the region. Last but not least, I mentioned the urgency we all feel for a just and lasting solution to the Cyprus problem and the necessary requirements for the acceptance of Turkey into the EU. Dear friends, the Balkans and the southeast of Europe in general continue to be a region of challenges. A challenge for the EU in its effort to close the last black hole, a challenge for NATO, which aims at rounding up its presence in a crucial geostrategic region, a challenge for Greece, naturally, the only old EU and NATO member in the region. Greece's challenges and the benefits from its role as both a political and economic actor in the region have not been entirely met. Neither have the EU's. We are on the same boat. A lot remains to be done before the Balkans are safely inside the Euro-Atlantic institutions, before they also enjoy the peace and prosperity of the relative peace and prosperity, or rather the peace and relative prosperity that we enjoy in the EU. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Dimitri, very much. I enjoyed that. Whilst you're gathering your thoughts and your questions, because Dimitris has covered a number of topics, and I'm sure there are a number of aspects you wish to pursue, perhaps I can just start by asking one question in the context where you're now a former Secretary-General, perhaps able to speak a little more freely. If you were giving the new government one particular recommendation about Greece's policy towards the rest of the Balkans in particular, what would that recommendation be? What would be the main points of concern that you would have with the new government?
Thank you for asking this question. I think I indicated something of an answer before. I would say that a Thessaloniki B, renewing the agenda, closing, building the missing links, closing the gaps, helping these countries modernize institutionally would be an imperative for a new Greek government. I think the new government, which does not intend to break, there is a national consensus in Greece on the basic red lines of our policies. I think it would be a good idea to renew the impetus of Greece's interest for the Balkans.
Okay. Now, I'm hoping you've formulated your questions and comments. Can I now throw it open to raise your points? If you could just simply identify who you are and then make your contribution or question, please, and I think the aspects being covered.
Yes, from the Hellenic Society. I'm afraid I have a quite critical question. I have been looking at sort of the role of Greece in the region, South European region, for a number of years now, and the main sort of conclusion that I've come to is that there's a lot of, and I'm not the only one to say that, there's a lot of rhetoric, but not much actual action and results, and even worse, not much strategy. And I know this sounds, you know, quite too critical, but I mean, in a number of fora, but also in your presentation, you emphasize the role of Greece in a number of processes, including, for example, the establishment of the Regional Cooperation Council. And I think, you know, if you ask people from other parts of the region, they would say that the earthquake was not that significant. If you speak to people from Mr. Bushek from the Stability Party, he would say that the earthquake was not particularly important. The Saloniki Declaration, which we all, you know, we're very happy about, you know, to emphasize the earthquake, it happened in Greece. It was a European Council, and I don't think if the location, the geographical location was different, the results would be that much different. We do promote the European perspective of the region, but with many, many sort of question marks and problems. You mentioned the issue of the constitutional name of the former Yugoslavia, Macedonia, our approach to Kosovo, perhaps the consistency, how we see, you know, the argument that problems should be solved before accession in the case of our northern borders. Perhaps problems can be imported into the European Union in the case of Cyprus. This kind of inconsistency, I think, gives to me the impression that we do develop a rhetoric that Greece has a very key role in the region. But effectively what happens is that we entertain ourselves in the sense that, you know, we're part of a process which is pretty much a European process, and whatever developments take place really, you know, are very much decided in, you know, somewhere else. The last example, the Corfu process on
the
relation, the Corfu process with the relations with Russia. I think it's a very big assumption, you know, a very strong statement to say that Greece has a key role in the EU.
I didn't say that.
No, I didn't say that.
I said it was just a step. And in a recent meeting in Bled, in Slovenia, everybody who took the floor mentioned that. It was not the Greek side who said so. But let me answer your other assumption. It is natural, to some extent, there is a lot of substance in what you said, in the following sense, that when a country does have a strategy for its own region, it doesn't cease at the same time belonging to the region and in other aspects being also entangled in some of the problems of the region. This is unavoidable for anything but the Baltic area. This is unavoidable. But the position we have taken, first of all, let me clarify that the Thessaloniki agenda, there was a clear preparation, even though it was not our government, but it was a clear preparation of the whole agenda by the then Greek government. It was not just a matter of location, it was a matter of a strategy, very carefully pursued by Mr. Kranidiotis at the time, who was at one time predecessor of mine in this post. But also, it led to the creation of the stabilization and association process for many of these countries, which is a clear framework of a pre-accession. So it is very important. So now the Greek strategy remains the same. The fact that there are problems with the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, this is not our doing. Our word and is clear. We want this country into NATO and the EU, provided it meets the criteria. Just a few months ago, last year, they had a highly rigged election. They corrected this. There is a central control of the entire communication system of the country. The conditions, even if they didn't have anything to do with Greece. I do understand that the Commission wants to help them go ahead, but it is equally understandable that when a country faces a problem of that magnitude, which touches upon good neighborly relations, you know, we have been conceding for the public good, quote-unquote, for many years. I'll cite one example. This business of calling this country from Vardarska, calling it Macedonia, etc., started in 1944. It was an idea of Tito and Stalin. The idea was not so much to upgrade that population over there, but to get an exit into the Aegean. And that's what lies in the root of a large part of the roots of the Greek Civil War. Therefore, it's not a matter of ancient history. For many populations in the Greek north, this is a matter of recent memories, as well as for the Slav Macedonian people who also suffered. But and this is a problem that must be solved. And there is another aspect. As I told once Doris Packen, the parliamentarian, said, forget history. If you have two sides of Macedonia, the one, the Slav one and the Greek one, and all of them calling their products Macedonian, you are going to end up in hell in the EU. Remember what happened with the Danish feta? It took 20 years to fix the Danish feta issue. Imagine if you have 150 products with branding problems before the European Court. I cite the smallest example. So it must be settled. That's our impression. And I think Greece made a huge step forward by accepting that, dropping its previous position, saying you can call yourselves Macedonia, providing you say which part of Macedonia you are, because there's a Macedonia in Greece, which is the largest. There is a Macedonia, the Pirene Macedonia in Bulgaria, and the tiny part in Albania. Macedonia is a geographical notion, and just as Portugal doesn't claim it's the Republic of Iberia, that it, the same we desire to happen in, and also with Turkey. It's a matter of Turkey. As Minister Bakoyannis said, takes two to tango. The EU has put some prerequisites. If Turkey does not wish to withdraw the army from politics completely, to respect minorities, to respect religious rights, etc., no country under these conditions enter the EU. And allow me to tell you that vis-à-vis Turkey, we have been extremely lenient. And I'll say why. I cannot imagine of another country starting accession negotiations with the EU while occupying territory of one member state and threatening with war another. So I think we have exhausted our leniency in giving it the chance to start negotiations, and now, 3 years after the framework was set in 2006, the evaluation is in December and nothing has happened. Nothing. They don't apply the Ankara Protocol. They don't extend the customs union to Cyprus with the EU. They negotiate with a union of which they don't recognize a member. This is bizarre, to say the least. And so it's not Greece's doing. If there are problems, they are not Greece's doing. But the strategy, even in this case, Greece has said Turkey, if Turkey fulfills the criteria, Turkey must become a member. We don't share the French view of excluding Turkey from the European architecture. But there are four words of the Greek strategy: full compliance, full membership. Four words, but we mean them. Hello. Professor Wallace.
Can I ask a different version of the same question? I'm not questioning at all the depth of commitment that you and your colleagues have had to the policies that you've been pursuing. But from the outside, I think you suffer from us seeing too much of these very idiosyncratic questions and we don't see enough of your efforts to make these other constructive steps forward. And I just wondered if you'd like to reflect a little bit on the ease or difficulty for you in developing alliances with other European Union members. For example, the way the Poles got the Swedes lined up on Eastern Partnership was very clever. And the Swedes weren't quite sure what they committed to.
I'm afraid you're right, in the sense the reason why some of these positions are not easily understood or taken over by our friends and allies is sometimes very practical. I will cite one example: the difference in the provenance and the education of the political class across Europe. We used to have a much better understanding of our issues in the 19th century, when everybody knew his Thucydides. Now people, frankly, are bored, particularly in the United States. If you explain a historical argument, they get exhausted in about 2 minutes. So when an issue is so complicated, so entangled, I assume you have read the letter addressed to President Obama by the 300 academics, some of them top academics, on the issue of whether Macedonia should be called Macedonia, and they invite the president to stop encouraging the falsification of history. But, you know, I doubt whether Obama has read it or Clinton for that matter. This is the sort of argument that was very popular before the First World War. People now want to be practical. For example, I will go take your question further and be critical and say, they would say to us, if you are interested for the stability on the Balkans, why don't you overlook these issues with the this tiny state cannot be a threat to you. But when I was put before this argument by the American administration in January 2008, I paid a crucial visit in Washington to prepare the ground for our refusal at Bucharest, and some of the highest standing people said, this is a tiny, they all had their own line of argument, this is a tiny state, what are you afraid of it? Can it have territorial ambitions over Greece? Greece has 400 warplanes and they only have 2 helicopters, or something like that. And that they are very small, etc., etc., etc. So my only line of argument at the end of this discussion was answering by a question. So presumably you don't mind Cuba. Because by all these measures, Cuba is also insignificant compared to the United States. But they still, it's still central to what the Americans try to do in the in their continent. Yes, there is, as you said, there is a problem in keeping a balance between the overall strategy, which is a strategy of expansion, Euro-Atlantic, and also, at the same time, not fully relinquishing your national interests. This is a balance always when you are between international institutions and your own state's needs. It's unavoidable to a great extent. It is not exactly the Eastern Partnership that annoys Russia. It is mostly the expansion of NATO without it being consulted, as you know. They think we have gone under her soft belly. And this partially, as you know, I'm not going to repeat all these articles written and analysis done all these last 2 years, but we have to understand, in dealing with Russia, I think old Greek wisdom says the following. Russia is a country extremely new to civil society. It's a country whose civil society was about to be born when the communist revolution occurred. So it doesn't have anything of the depth of our societies with democratic institutions and civil society. The first, now, the transitional stage in Russia, it is very important to pressure Russia for civil reform, democracy, human rights, protecting civil society, NGOs, the freedom of the press, etc. It's imperative that we keep this pressure. At the same time, we must understand they cannot overnight be like the Czech Republic, which was a completely different state before the war, or Poland. They're a different country. It is a country which lived for 1,000 years since they became officially a nation in the late 10th century after their baptism in the Dnieper River. They have always been a totalitarian state, either Tsarist or communist. So, for us to demand that Russia be exactly like us overnight, it's difficult. So, this is one thing we have to take into account. The second thing is that there are many people, both in Washington and in Moscow, which have not quite understood that the Cold War is over. This applies for some people in Moscow, perhaps more in Moscow now that the administration changed. But we have to deal with all these issues. We have to create, therefore, an atmosphere of trust with Russia. And building an atmosphere of trust, then we can build the institutions of our cooperation. It's not easy. The process, as you know, is still ongoing. The EU, we had this structured dialogue, as we call it, with Russia, etc. And this dialogue is in process. I wouldn't be desperate about it. There are some positive signs. So let us wait and see how this EU policy of engaging rather than alienating Russia develops. Now, as far as the Eastern Partnership, this is about helping the countries in the immediate periphery. It's mostly economic, institutional, etc. Russia, as you say, probably would mind some of them becoming members of the EU. But to conclude, as I started, she minds, I think, Mrs. Wallace, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Russia minds much more membership of NATO than the EU in of these countries.
Thanks. There are several hands up. Can we take a collection of
yes.
Gentlemen,
as a European university student, why did Greece put aside the Helsinki framework with regard to the solution of the Aegean problems? And I'm asking this question because I think in problems like the issue of Macedonian name, there is enough political space to argue that the blame is also on the part of the other side. But what about when you have like clear process? What's the answer to that?
I think that we're taking
the of Greece being a stabilizing factor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Selectively or
Thanks. There were other hands being shown as well. Okay.
George Perelect, I'm at the Sorbonne, and also at the Hélène Conservatoire. As a research, a senior research, National Bank of Greece, senior research. Well, you have extremely have been extremely eloquent in presenting what I call the doctrine of the Greek foreign policy. And it is a doctrine which is, I think, more or less accepted by both parties. It is convincing as long as we accept the logic of rights and the argumentation, especially if it is presented in such an eloquent way. But foreign policy is not only about discourse, it's also about results. And we see the threat of Greece being isolated diplomatically because it is not understood on its positions in Macedonia since we are not in the 19th century, because the issue of Turkey in the European Union leads both those who are in favor and those who are against Turkey's entrance in accusing Cyprus in Greece. It is convenient to those who do not want Turkey in to say that it is the problem of Cyprus in Greece, and also those who are in favor of the accused. So if we are on the right side but we are not efficient, maybe that should lead us in some kind of self-criticism and in trying to reinvent this doctrine. So how do you see that? Are we in such a process of rethinking, and in what directions would that be?
Thank you. Any other questions at this stage?
Yeah, I'll answer those two first. First of all, it is the abandoning the Helsinki Accord is merely a phrase, convenient phrase used by the present government when it was in opposition. There was no such abandonment. Allow me to be a better judge of that. Being as Secretary General for European Affairs, I was following in a detailed fashion, everyday fashion, the negotiations. Everything agreed on our part, on the EU side, all our obligations were met. And Greece didn't go back on its position in Helsinki. It actually moved ahead to complete the framework. And today, whatever was arranged is in the Euro-Turkish framework. For example, solving territorial disputes, etc., etc. But there must be, you cannot start solving disputes when you have overflights on a daily basis, and this is something you can't avoid. I mean, there is no Greek politician who doesn't mention that to Turkey, that they jeopardize their, how do you call it, their process, their EU process, by being acting in this behavior. So I don't think I don't think it is true, actually, that we are in pressure for, it is, in some ways it's true that people who are pro-Turkey and say, well, forget it now, let's start the negotiations, let's accelerate the negotiations a little bit more. But then remember, 8 chapters are blocked by the EU as a whole because of the non-appliance of the protocol, that is the extension of the customs union to Cyprus. They don't allow Turkish Cypriot vessels. And then another 5 chapters are blockaded by France. And then if you look at the Commission's report this year, you will see that in the non-political chapters, the vast majority of chapters present problems. You will see the Commission signing this limited progress, very little progress. There is only 2 or 3 articles in which parts of them, they say, relatively satisfactory progress. So there is the problem, as I said, is a problem Turkey faces in adjusting. So as long as they don't adjust and Greece keeps pointing this out, but we are not the only ones to point it out, and we are not the harder liners vis-à-vis Turkey, as you know very well. Hard liners are the Germans, the Austrians, the French, etc. It's not Greece. Greece is simply pointing out that certain obligations must be met, and this is something we cannot change, be it Helsinki or non-Helsinki. The difference is, maybe there should be a more, if you want a criticism, I could give you a criticism. I have a personal idea, and I can say it now, out of office, that you need to entangle yourself personally as much as you can. I mean, for example, my government's decision not to have direct political contacts with Skopje because of their provocative attitude, I would not do it. I would go to Skopje, I would invite them to Chalkidiki for a weekend. I don't know what I would have done, but I would discuss straightforward with them. I remember I was on a journey, or for another reason, for another meeting in Dubrovnik, and I happened to sit at the same table with Elenovsky, the Minister of Defense, and the then negotiator, Dimitrov. And I must say the discussion developed so well for the Greek side that Daniel Fried, who was present, said, why don't you simply accept what the chap says? And it was sort of so friendly that I almost felt that if this was done consistently and without a feeling that you are antagonizing, maybe, just maybe, there might have been results. But I don't know. But I simply tell you what my impulse would be, what to do. So you can't avoid being viewed, because people don't have the time, people don't have the energy, and to completely change the mind frame of every one of your friends and allies is not easy.
But I think that this is the task of the victim.
Yeah.
And I believe that,
let me not forget, we have done exactly what you said in Bucharest. In Bucharest, we didn't pose a veto. We discussed with our allies, and we took a common stand. And if that's not a diplomatic success, what is one? And then a few months later, at the summit in Brussels in June, the same, without a veto, was, and I wish the present government manages to go through December without the need for a veto. We didn't require a veto, we persuaded. And that was, it was an answer to what you say.
I understand all that, but what counts is the result, whether you win or you lose.
We'll have to wait.
And you say that I did all I could, you still have lost. But let me add one thing about Turkey. agree absolutely with you. Many years ago, the role of Greece was to refuse
everything
Turkey, so that other nations that did not want Turkey would say it is the fault of the Greeks, and therefore
the famous hiding behind the Greek back. It was.
Thank God, Greece managed to get out of this trap. I think we have gotten again into the trap, not so much because we are doing the wrong thing, but simply because there is such a situation that you cannot do anything else. I mean, you cannot deny yourself. Take Cyprus. Since Cyprus is inside the European Union, Cyprus cannot commit suicide.
Yes.
So Cyprus is trapped, sooner or later, to veto, and therefore to be instrumentalized by other actors in Europe, and therefore to become again, and in this way we are at this moment at a situation whether Greece is on the right side or the wrong side, to be accused both for the question of stability in southern Balkans around the question of Macedonia, and to be accused. And I think that this is a difficult moment that has to be thought in many new ways.
There was, for the first time for many years, there was a strategy for these issues. For the so-called Macedonian issue, for example, I must say I'm strongly critical of the previous PASOK government, for the very simple reason that after signing the interim accord, there was a complete lack of action for at least 10 years. So the recognitions came when the United States recognized Skopje. It was the 115th recognition, so they had something to put their legs on. And I'll tell you one detail: there was not one paper in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs with an order saying prevent recognitions in that period. I've looked deep into the archives. There was nothing saying. It was the most obvious thing that they should have done. The minister should ask the relevant directorate. Now the interim accord is signed, prevent recognitions, and not go and protest after recognitions were happening. So now there is a state fait accompli in many ways. And I think the compromise suggested by Greece is reasonable. There are still those, as you know, who say Greece should never accept the word Macedonia, it's a treason, etc. But Greece has a very logical position. And also, what I also try to emphasize in my speech is that we are practically on the ground doing whatever we can to show our goodwill to the people of that republic by investing. I'll tell you a detail which very few people know. We pay a very, very expensive train, an intercity, to go between Skopje and Thessaloniki daily, half empty, out of the Greek taxpayers' pocket. So there's nothing we don't do to help this state. But it is also a bad coincidence, I must say, that the new government in Skopje is much less moderate than her predecessors. And this was nothing Greece could do about that.
Thank you. Unless there are any less pressing comments or questions, I'll bring things to a conclusion on your behalf. I'd like to thank Dimitris Katsoulis for his presentation. And I think, in light of what's been said this evening, Dimitri, I think actually the LSE should be in touch with its alumni in the new government. One of those alumni is Mrs. Luca Cazzelli, a graduate of the LSE. And I know that she's very keen on questions of public and private ownership in the recent past. I think really the LSE should urge Mrs. Cazzelli to bring the Dimitris Katsoulis into public ownership. So on your behalf, can I thank our speaker this evening, my friend Dimitris Katsoulis.
Thank you very much. This I can leave here.